operating around the clock, employing thousands of people, supplying the German war machine with millions of ball bearings a month. Schweinfurt was a bomber mafia fantasy.
If you took out that target, it could have the potential to take down the entire German war economy. This is what the Americans were looking for, and they thought ball bearings might be that target.
Tammy Biddle.
It's sort of like taking the key card out of a house of cards and having the whole thing collapse, or pulling on the thread of a spider web and having the whole thing unravel. That's what the Americans thought they were going to do. Again, it's very ambitious. It's resting on assumptions that were unproven but very hopeful.
The Army Air Force strategists drew up one of the most ingenious plans of the war, a raid in two parts. The main event would involve 230 B-17 bombers sent against the Schweinfurt ball bearing factories. But to make the main event possible, there was to be a diversion. Just before the B-17s left for Schweinfurt, another fleet of B-17s would take off for Regensburg, a small city to the southeast of Schweinfurt. The Germans made their Messerschmitt fighter plane there. The idea was the Regensburg attack would draw off the German defenders, occupy them, distract them, leaving a clear path for the bomber group headed for Schweinfurt. The bombers heading for Regensburg would be bait. And who did they choose to command this crucial, treacherous arm of the Schweinfurt raid? The best combat commander they could find, a young colonel named Curtis Emerson LeMay. Curtis LeMay came from a poor neighborhood in Columbus, Ohio, the eldest of a large family that struggled financially. He put himself through engineering school at Ohio State, working night shifts at a foundry. He joined the Army out of college, and his ascent through the Air Corps was breathtaking. A captain by 33, then a major, colonel, a brigadier general, and by the age of 37, a major general. LeMay was a bulldog. Oversized square head, hair parted triumphantly just a shade off the middle, a brilliant poker player, a crack shot, a mind that moved only forwards, never sideways, rational and imperturbable and incapable of self-doubt. Just listen to this little bit of unedited footage from sometime in 1943. LeMay is in England, heading up the 305th Bombardment Group. He's just landed after taking his men on a bombing run.
Colonel LeMay, how'd the trip go today?
Well, it went pretty well, except that it's rather dull compared to some that we've had. There weren't many fighters up, and the flak was just moderate and very inaccurate.
A film crew has come to interview his airmen after the mission. The rest of the men are laughing, excited. A film crew, a chance to shine. LeMay looks expressionless at the camera. Short, barrel-chested, pugnacious. That raid deep in enemy territory, it was all rather dull.
This formation that you put out for us last night, did you conform to that on our trip, Ben?
Yes, we flew the same formation as we mentioned last night.
How about your bombardier? Was he operating all right?
He worked 100% as usual.
Major Preston here, did he perform his duties properly?
Yes, he's right on the ball, the same as he always is.
No inflection, no elaboration. It's safe to say that Colonel LeMay did not serenade his men with the man on the flying trapeze.
How about the men? Did they perform their duties and crews right up to par? You don't have any complaints, in other words?
No complaints at all.
No complaints at all. Curtis LeMay was not the sort to complain, not to an outsider anyway. Had the film crew interviewed Haywood Hansel, he would have waxed eloquent, dropped a few smart remarks at his own expense, then invited everyone back to his officer's quarters for a drink. Hansel was the anti-LeMay. When Hansel was at Maxwell Field before the war, he was part of a group of daredevil pilots led by the flying ace Claire Chennault. They performed impossibly dangerous stunts in planes that were not designed for that kind of adventure. As Hansel himself would admit, it's a miracle he survived. Hansel would join a daredevil group. It suited his romantic flair. LeMay? He was the opposite of romantic. Russell Daugherty, one of LeMay's fellow Air Force generals, loved to tell a story about a time, much later, when LeMay was briefed about a new airplane called the FB-111.
The briefings lasted about 2.5 days. And finally, they wrapped up the briefing. LeMay hadn't said a word the whole time. We just sitting there. After we got all through, General LeMay says, "Is that it?" "Yes, sir, that's it." And he got up and he says, "It ain't big enough," and walked out. That was his only comment.
A 2.5 day briefing dismissed with 4 words. In the fall of 1942, LeMay came to Britain with the 8th Air Force. He headed up a squadron of B-17 bombers based out of Chelveston, and he made his mark immediately. Here's one example. If you fly a fleet of B-17 bombers deep into enemy territory in order to precision bomb from 20,000 feet, how do you protect yourself from enemy fighter planes? Bombers had guns and armor plating, but it quickly became obvious once the shooting started that that still wasn't enough. So LeMay devised something called the Combat Box Formation, a way for a group of bombers to fly together so that they could most easily defend themselves against enemy attack. It was an idea quickly adopted by the whole 8th Air Force. Then LeMay turned his attention to an even bigger problem, his pilots.
One of the things that was very apparent was that the bombing was not very good.
This is LeMay, talking about the problem in an interview after the war. Bombers have cameras that take pictures of the area where their bombs fall, strike photos. And when LeMay looked at the strike photos after the crews had come back to base, he could see the bombs were landing everywhere but the target.
Not only were the targets not being destroyed, but we didn't have any records of where most of the bombs actually fell. They were taking strike photos, of course, but you could not locate over half the bombs that were hauled over to the continent.
The problem was that the pilots were not flying straight at the targets. They believed that would make them sitting ducks for anti-aircraft fire, because enemy artillerymen on the ground would simply estimate the plane's speed and altitude and aim accordingly. So the pilots were taking evasive action, not flying directly at the target until the last seconds of their bombing run, which is why the bombs were falling wide. How could the bombardier working the bombsite do his job if the plane was lined up over the target only at the very last moment?
So something had to be done to give the bombardier a chance to hit the target. This meant a longer bomb run to give him ample time to get his bombsite level and get the rate and drift killed in order to do a good job.
LeMay saw only one solution. The pilots had to stop taking evasive action. They had to fly straight in over the target.
All of the people that I talked to that had been in combat were of the opinion that if you did this, anti-aircraft guns would shoot you down.
Key phrase, of the opinion. LeMay was an empiricist. He went back and studied his old artillery manuals, did some calculations. How many rounds from an anti-aircraft gun would it take to bring down a B-17 bomber?
And it worked out it required, 370-some rounds to hit it. This didn't look too bad to me.
An anti-aircraft gun would have to fire 377 rounds if it hoped to disable a B-17 bomber flying straight at the target. 377 rounds is a lot of ammunition. So flying straight is a risk, but it's not a crazy risk. So LeMay says, let's try it. Let's fly in straight, a 7-minute long straight and steady approach. And if that sounded suicidal, which it did to all of his pilots, he says, I'm going to be the first to try it. So in a bombing run over Saint-Nazaire, France, in 1942, LeMay led the way. No evasive action. And what happened? His group put twice as many bombs on the target as any group had before and didn't lose a single bomber.
He was the finest combat commander of any service I came across in the war. But he was extraordinarily belligerent. Many thought brutal.
That's Robert McNamara, who would later become Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War. In World War II, McNamara ran analysis for the Army Air Forces. This is him in Errol Morris's brilliant documentary, The Fog of War, describing what LeMay did after he heard that so many pilots were turning tail.
He issued an order. He said, I will be in the lead plane on every mission. Any plane that takes off will go over the target, or the crew will be court-martialed. Now, that's the kind of a commander he was.
The Bomber Mafia were theorists, intellectuals, who conceived of their grand plans in the years before the war from the safety of Montgomery, Alabama. But Curtis LeMay was the one who figured out how to make those theories real.
I'll admit some uneasiness on my part and some of the other people in the outfit when we made that first straight-in bomb run, but it worked.
I'll admit some uneasiness, he says. That's it. Some uneasiness. One more LeMay story. Because the fascination that people have with LeMay, okay, the fascination I have with LeMay, is not that he was an extraordinary combat commander. There were plenty of those on both sides of the Second World War. The fascination comes from the unfathomable depths to his character, the sense he gave that he didn't have limits the way that normal people did, which was, in one sense, exhilarating, because it meant that LeMay could achieve things others could not even imagine. But at the same time, it gave people pause. What was the word McNamara used about LeMay? Brutal. And it's not like McNamara was warm and fuzzy. He would later direct the saturation bombing of North Vietnam. And LeMay gave him pause. So, one more story. The story that started all the whispers about LeMay in military circles. It happened back in 1937, when the possibility of war in Europe was growing real. The Army's Air Corps wanted a chance to practice their bombing technique. Real-world practice. Only with dummy bombs. 50-pounders filled with water. LeMay would talk about this exercise years later.
Let me tell you the story of that. I mentioned that the Air Force has been battling to make a contribution to the defense of the country ever since I've been around. Nobody paid much attention to it. We wanted an exercise where we could drop bombs on a battleship, find a battleship.
For the practice run to work, the Army Air Corps needed the Navy to play along, hide a battleship out on the seas, give out its coordinates at the last minute, and dare the bombers to find it. This was before sophisticated radar and navigation aids. To find a battleship, you had to see it with your eyes, then hit its narrow deck with a bomb from thousands of feet up, all the while flying at hundreds of miles an hour. The Navy was not enthusiastic.
Finally, they agreed that they would have an exercise, and it would be in August off the West Coast. Now, in August off the West Coast, there's nothing but fog for 1,000 miles out there. And they deliberately picked it at this time, I'm sure.
How could you spot a battleship in 1,000 miles of fog? To make matters worse, the Navy bent the rules. The agreement was to have the war game run for 24 hours, from noon the first day until noon the next. But the Navy didn't give out the coordinates of its ship, the USS Utah, until late the first afternoon. And the coordinates they gave were wrong. Off by 60 miles. 1,000 miles of fog, late directions, fake directions. A needle in a haystack would have been easier. At 10 minutes before noon, at the very last moment, LeMay found the ship and dropped his bombs. Now, of course he found the ship. There was nothing LeMay could not do if he put his mind to it. That's not the point of the story. The point is what was going on just before he dropped his bombs. The Navy was certain they couldn't be found, so they took no precautions. The sailors were just going about their business. They were supposed to take cover in a bombing exercise. They didn't. What did LeMay do? He bombed the Utah anyway, raining 50-pound water bombs down on the sailors.
And the Navy was so sure that they weren't going to be found underneath that fog blanket,
But the men were all over the decks. Everybody diving for the gangplank, hatches. And we heard rumors that there were a few people hurt a little bit.
In his memoirs, LeMay says he heard that some sailors actually got killed during the bombing exercise. And then he says, quote, "I remember watching the first bomb, which smashed into the deck. It sent splintered pieces of wood flying in every direction. I hadn't realized that wood could frag like that." He shrugs it off. His job was to find the ship, after all. And he did. And by the way, really good to know about the physics of a bomb hitting a wooden deck.
Curtis LeMay, in my view, he was the greatest air commander in history. Everything he touched, he transformed.
This is the military historian, Conrad Crane.
He was a dynamic leader. He shared the difficulties of his airmen. He was the best navigator the Air Force had. He was a great pilot. He could do mechanic stuff. He knew the technical as well as the leadership aspects of what he was doing. He was the Air Force's ultimate problem solver. But he was one of those guys that you would, if you gave him a problem to fix, you didn't ask a whole lot of questions how he was going to do it.
So imagine then the thinking of the bomber mafia in the summer of 1943. They needed to validate the theories formulated back at the Air Corps Tactical School. Deal a death blow to the Nazi war machine. Prove that ball bearings were the crucial choke point of the German military infrastructure. The Schweinfurt raid was their best chance to demonstrate that their way of waging an air war was superior to the British. Who would you choose to plan the mission? Heywood Hansell, of course, the high priest of Maxwell Field, one of your very best. But who would you choose to lead the most difficult part of the mission, the dummy raid on Regensburg? There really wasn't any other option. Chapter 5. General Hansell was aghast. The orders given to Curtis LeMay on the eve of the Schweinfurt raid called for him to lead an elaborate decoy mission. He would take off first with the 4th Bombardment Wing, a fleet of B-17 bombers, and then head for the Messerschmitt aircraft factories in Regensburg. The idea was that LeMay's group would tie up the Germans defending the Messerschmitt factories, and then they would keep going, through the Alps to North Africa, in the hopes of luring the German fighter planes as far away as possible from the corner of Bavaria where the ball-bearing factories were.
We'd go on and hit Regensburg and go on out through the Winter Pass, but we wouldn't have to fight coming out. We'd bear the brunt going in of the German fighter force.
Then the real bombing force would arrive.
They'd get in practically free, but they'd have to fight coming out.
LeMay being LeMay, long before the day of the attack, he worried about the weather. They were taking off from England, the land of mist and fog. So in the days leading up to the raid, he had his crews practice blind takeoffs, day after day. Sure enough, on the morning of the mission, August 17th, the fog was terrible.
It's stinking over England. As a matter of fact, we went out that morning. I had to take lanterns and flashlights and lead the airplanes out from the hard stands to the end of the runway.
LeMay leads his men off into the gloom. Once they enter occupied France, the German fighters start to emerge from behind the clouds. One of LeMay's pilots, Bernd Ley, wrote an article for the Saturday Evening Post a few months later describing the Regensburg raid. And it's harrowing. A shining silver rectangle of metal sailed past over our right wing. I recognized it as a main exit door. Seconds later, a black lump came hurtling through the formation, barely missing several propellers. It was a man, clasping his knees to his head, revolving like a diver in a triple somersault, shooting by us so close that I saw a piece of paper blow out of his leather jacket. Now that we had been under constant attack for more than an hour, it appeared certain that our group was faced with extinction. The sky was still mottled with rising fighters. Target time was 35 minutes away. I doubt if a man in the group visualized the possibility of our getting much farther without 100% loss. Lay describes another plane in his group, hit six times. One 20-millimeter cannon shell penetrated the right side of the airplane and exploded beneath the pilot, cutting one of the gunners in the leg. A second shell hit the radio compartment, cutting the legs of the radio operator off at the knees. He bled to death. A third hit the bombardier in the head and shoulder. A fourth shell hit the cockpit, taking out the plane's hydraulic system. A fifth severed the rudder cables. A sixth hit the number three engine, setting it on fire. This was all one plane. The pilot kept flying. The attacks went on for hours before they even reached Regensburg. The only solace they had was the thought that they were making life easier for the real attack, the one poised to cripple the Nazis' war machine. Except the carefully constructed decoy mission turned out to be not much of a decoy at all. LeMay's pilots had been able to take off in the soupy fog of that August morning because he'd trained them for just that challenge, drilled them, takeoff after takeoff, use your instruments only, act as if you can't see anything outside. But no other group commander did what LeMay did. The flight crews were exhausted from their long runs into Germany, devastated by the loss of comrades. Do you know how hard it is for a commander to turn to his crews and say, this morning at 6 a.m., we're going to practice blind takeoffs because of the possibility of fog on some future mission? Only LeMay could do that, because he was relentless, a stickler. He didn't care if his men were grumbling as he pushed them on what must have seemed like a pointless exercise. Meanwhile, was Haywood Hansel paying attention to this detail? No, he was back in Washington, thinking loftier thoughts. So that morning, the bombers of the 1st Bombardment Wing were stranded on the tarmac until the weather cleared. They were supposed to take off 10 minutes behind LeMay. They actually took off hours behind LeMay, which gave the German defenders time to regroup and launch the same ferocious assault on the Schweinfurt raid as they had a few hours earlier on the Regensburg raid. In the end, there were two bloodbaths that day.
I had 125 airplanes. I lost 24, I think, which is not bad. But we only had a one-way trip. I make the 1st Division coming in. An hour later, the German fighters are landed and back up again in force, and they have to fight coming in and going out, too. They lost about 50, 60 airplanes.
Those are staggering losses. An Air Force that launched raids like that on a regular basis would quickly put itself out of business.
Göring's Luftwaffe unleashed every trick. The B-17 suffered the most savage blows since the war began.
Even in its official histories, the Air Force could not hide the disaster.
We who carried the war 500 miles to the enemy's industrial heart knew better than anyone how expensive it was.
But at least the mission took out the ball-bearing plants of Schweinfurt, crippling the German war effort, right?
Flying in enemy territory, we felt like goldfish in a bowl, waiting for the attack. It didn't matter. We had a job to do on Schweinfurt. We had 400 tons of high explosives to deliver.
The bombardiers peer into their sights. The bomb bay doors open. The bombs fall in cascading waves. Then we see Germany far down below, erupting with explosion after explosion.
After getting 80 hits on the two main ball-bearing plants, we could defend ourselves again, at least to the extent of evasive action against flak and fighter attack. But the main idea now is to get home fast.
230 bombers, each carrying 8 to 9 bombs. So let's say 2,000 bombs dropped in total. And they get 80 hits. That doesn't sound like precision bombing, does it? The fundamental problem at Schweinfurt was not the botched execution of the battle plan, however. That was just a symptom. The real problem had to do with the mechanical cornerstone of the bomber mafia ideology, the Norden bombsight.
In all likelihood, some one of you now sitting in this room will see one of these targets, not projected on a screen, but moving under the crosshair of your bombsight.
As it turned out, the bombsight did not behave in the real world the way it had in Carl Norden's laboratory or in military training films. I asked historian Stephen McFarland about this.
So if everything was perfect, if all of the data I entered into the Norden bombsight is accurate, I'm well trained in the use of it, the weather is, I can see my sight, you know, everything goes according to plan, does it work in theory?
Well, in theory, yes, if you're talking about strictly a mathematical issue. But remember that when gears and pulleys are moving, they cause friction. And I don't care how much you polish the ball bearings, I don't care how perfect the tolerances, you're still going to run into the issue of friction. And the slightest little bit of friction means that your analog equivalent to that mathematical formula has been messed up. It doesn't work that way anymore.
The Norden bombsight is a mechanical object. If you built them by hand, you could make sure that every component fitted perfectly and every tolerance was exact. But when the war hit, the military needed tens of thousands of machines.
And of course, once it's out of the factory too, you know, oils will start to thicken. You know, at 25,000 feet, the temperature might be 60 degrees below zero. And the oils that are lubricating the gears and pulleys are going to thicken and therefore cause a little bit of friction.
Now imagine that temperamental device in the hands of a bombardier, some kid fresh out of training school on an actual bombing run.
And people are shooting at you and enemy aircraft are coming at you at closing speeds of 500 and 600 miles an hour. And all this horrible yelling and screaming and bombs going, explosions going off and everything else. The bombardiers tended to pucker, if I can use that phrase. They would lean forward as they became more and more intent on trying to make sure the crosshair stayed on the target. And when they did so, they actually changed the angle of vision through that telescope. It was almost impossible.
And I haven't mentioned the most important factor of all, the weather. The Norden depended on visual sighting of the target. You looked through the telescope, saw what you wanted to hit, then entered all the information, wind direction and airspeed and temperature and the curvature of the earth and so on. But of course, if there were clouds over the target, nothing worked. In the days before sophisticated radar, there was no way around this problem. You crossed your fingers and prayed for a sunny day. If you got clouds instead, sometimes you would scrub the mission, but as often as not, you'd go anyway and take your chances. You had to. If you lingered too long on the tarmac, you would lose the element of surprise. So the 8th Air Force took off, in the fog, for the ball-bearing factories of Schweinfurt, dropped 2,000 bombs, and of those, 80 found their mark. 80 bombs is just not enough to destroy a sprawling industrial complex. When an employee of the Kugelfischer ball-bearing plant, one of the largest in the country, toured his factory after the attack, he found the upper floor of his building had completely collapsed. There was debris everywhere. But at least half of the crucial machinery was intact, which meant he could soon get it back up and running. Heywood Hansel thought he had found the classic choke point, the equivalent of that propeller spring factory in Pittsburgh. But a plant that can be back up and running within a few weeks is not a choke point. The best estimate was that the attack decreased German ball-bearing production by about a third. 60 planes down and 552 airmen captured or dead. For that? The Army's official post-mortem of its bombing missions, the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey, concluded afterwards that, quote, "There is no evidence that the attacks on the ball-bearing industry had any measurable effect on essential war production," end of quote.
The Americans were very outspoken about how much superior their method and their technique and their doctrine was. Even when they had no grounds to be that bold and that confident because they hadn't really proven anything. They hadn't done much, but they were, you know, basically cocky Americans who went into the theater thinking that, the rules were going to be different for them and they were going to be able to do things that the British hadn't been able to achieve.
So what do the Bomber Mafia do after the disaster of Schweinfurt? They try again. Of course they do. They're cocky Americans. In the fall of 1943, the 8th Air Force hits Schweinfurt a second time. A few years after the war, a movie came out called 12 O'Clock High. It was based on a book written by Byrne Lay, the pilot under LeMay, who I quoted before. 12 O'Clock High starred Gregory Peck as the leader of an attack on a ball bearing factory. It's worth watching because it perfectly captures the persistence of the Bomber Mafia's vision. They had failed the first time, but it didn't matter. They would try again. Whatever evidence was slowly gathering about the limitations of the Norden bomb site didn't faze them.
There's only one hope of shortening this war. Daylight precision bombing. We fold, daylight bombing is done with.
This is the character General Pritchard, modeled after Ira Aker, head of the 8th Air Force.
You can smell what's coming, Frank. I'm promising you nothing except a job no man should have to do who's already had more than his share of combat. I've got to ask you to take nice kids and fly them until they can't take any more. Then put them back in and fly them some more.
What the movie doesn't do is follow the actual sequence of the first and second Schweinfurt raids, for obvious Hollywood reasons. Because the second Schweinfurt raid was only marginally more successful than the first. They did more damage, but the German aircraft industry didn't grind to a halt that time either. Not even close. And how many planes did the 8th Air Force lose in that second raid? 60 outright, 17 damaged so badly that they had to be mothballed, 650 airmen killed or captured. Nearly a quarter of the crews on that mission did not come home. Shortly afterwards, Ira Aker, the leader of the 8th Air Force, was reassigned, shunted over to the Mediterranean Theater, which is the military equivalent of being sent to your room without dinner. ...1943 was a dark time for the Bomber Mafia. Every one of their ideas crumbled in the face of reality. They were supposed to be able to put a bomb inside a pickle barrel at 30,000 feet. That was a joke. And the bomber was supposed to fly so high and so fast that no one could touch it. Are you kidding me? Airmen of the 8th Air Force were required to fly 25 missions to complete their tour of service. And if you were part of that second Schweinfurt mission, where a fifth of the planes don't come back, well, you do the math. Fly 25 missions like that, and what are your odds of making it through the war alive?
We were assigned to a squadron, 367th Bomb Squadron.
There are dozens of interviews online from World War II airmen remembering those desperate months. This is George Roberts, a B-17 radio operator with the 8th Air Force.
And I noticed a big sign out there. It says, home of the 367th Clay Pigeon Air Force. Boy, and I thought, what a funny name to call an outfit, Clay Pigeons. I was to find out later that the Clay Pigeons was a pretty good name for that squadron.
A clay pigeon is the name given to the targets used for shooting competitions. Discs made out of clay so they shatter on impact, colored fluorescent orange so they're hard to miss. That's not an encouraging name for a bombing squadron. As the war over Europe dragged on, the pressure on the Bomber Mafia grew. The British became more and more contemptuous of the 8th Bomber Command, and the brass back in Washington tried to push the air war in a new direction. They called for another major raid on Germany, an attack on the German city of Munster. Only Munster wasn't an industrial center. It didn't have an aircraft factory or a ball-bearing plant or an oil refinery. It was just a charming medieval town full of German civilians.
It was on a Sunday, nice sunshiny day, beautiful day, and the target was the build-up section of Munster. And I thought it was rather inappropriate that these large set of steps to one big building in Munster was picked out as the aiming point.
That's from a pilot who flew the mission, Keith Harris. And the large set of steps in one big building in the built-up section of Munster, he's talking about the Munster Cathedral. The 8th Air Force was being directed to bomb a church on a Sunday at midday as people were coming out of Mass. At the pre-flight briefing, the airmen had been in shock. This wasn't what they had signed on to do. It wasn't what the 8th Air Force stood for. One navigator, who had been raised in a strict Methodist house, went up to his commanding officer and said he couldn't do it. This was British-style area bombing, not American bombing. The navigator was told he'd face court-martial if he didn't fly the mission. So he did. You know who else was in the briefing room that day, trying to wrap his head around what was happening? Heywood Hansell. One of his airmen later wrote simply, "General Hansell was aghast." During the war, a young statistician named Leon Festinger worked on a project for the Army Air Forces. His job was to devise better ways of selecting people for pilot training, which sounds like a dry academic exercise until you remember how dire things were for the Air Forces in the long months of 1943. Festinger's job was to figure out which young men should be sent to what, statistically speaking, was an almost certain death. Leon Festinger went on to become one of the most famous social psychologists in the country, and I've always wondered whether Festinger's experience with the Air Forces was the motivation after the war for his most famous study, an analysis of a cult out of Chicago called the Seekers. Because Festinger approached the Seekers with a question that must have crossed his mind years before. What happens to true believers when their convictions are confronted by reality?
The idea that you have to supply cognition that will fit with, that will justify what you feel or what you do, made us immediately the first thing we thought of, well, if this operates, it must be a very pervasive thing.
The leader of the Seekers was a woman named Dorothy Martin, who claimed to be in contact with a group of aliens she called the Guardians. The Guardians told her, she said, that the world was going to be destroyed by flood on December 21st, 1954. But a few days before the apocalypse happened, she and her followers would be rescued by a flying saucer that would land in her backyard. In preparation for this moment, the Seekers quit their jobs, left their families, and gave away their possessions. They gathered in Dorothy Martin's house in the Chicago suburb of Oak Park. At first, Martin said, the flying saucer was supposed to arrive at 4 o'clock on December 17th. The aliens didn't come. Then, at midnight, another message. The saucer was on its way. Didn't happen. Then she said the aliens had given her a new date, midnight on December 21st, just before the apocalypse. So the Seekers gathered again in Martin's living room and waited and waited.
They were preparing for a cataclysm and for their personal salvation.
It's worth reading from the opening pages of Festinger's account of that final night at Dorothy Martin's house. He writes, "Suppose an individual believes something with his whole heart. Suppose further that he has a commitment to this belief, that he has taken irrevocable actions because of it. Finally, suppose that he is presented with evidence, unequivocal and undeniable evidence, that his belief is wrong. What will happen?" Festinger and two colleagues asked Dorothy Martin if they could observe the Seekers as they waited. And in his book, When Prophecy Fails, Festinger describes moment by moment what happened. When the clock on the mantel showed only 1 minute remaining before the saucer was due, Dorothy Martin exclaimed in a strained, high-pitched voice, "And not a plan has gone astray." The clock chimed 12, each stroke painfully clear in the expectant hush. The believers sat motionless. Festinger goes on, "One might have expected some visible reaction. Midnight had passed and nothing had happened. The cataclysm was less than 7 hours away. But there was little to see in the reactions of the people in that room. There was no talking, no sound. People sat stock still, their faces seemingly frozen and expressionless. The seekers stayed rooted in their seats for hours, slowly coming to terms with the fact that no visitor from outer space would be coming to their rescue. But did disconfirmation of their belief cause them all to abandon it? No. At 4:45 that morning, Martin announced that she had gotten another message. Because of the unwavering faith of the seekers, she said, God had called off the destruction of the world. What did Festinger make of all this? The more you invest in a set of beliefs, the greater the sacrifice you make in the service of that conviction, the more resistant you will be to evidence that suggests you are mistaken. You don't give up. You double down.
The general principle seems to be that people come to believe in and to love the things they have to suffer for.
So, did the disaster of the Schweinfurt raids and the long discouraging summer and fall of 1943 lead Haywood Hansell and the Bomber Mafia to give up? Of course not. You know what Hansell wrote to Ira Aker after the first attack on Schweinfurt on August 17th? I need not say how tremendously proud I was of the Regensburg-Schweinfurt operation. In spite of the very heavy losses, I believe it was completely justified and represents one of the turning points of the war. Which is, of course, delusional. Schweinfurt was not a turning point of the war, but if you asked Hansell why he believed that, he would have given you his reasons. They were still learning. They got unlucky with the weather. They should have gone back the next week and hit it again and again until every plant was completely destroyed. Or maybe ball bearings weren't the best of targets after all. But there were others, weren't there? What about oil refineries? That's how a true believer's mind works. But outside that tight-knit circle was another man, Curtis LeMay. Though he'd been to the Air Corps Tactical School down at Maxwell for his obligatory training like everyone else, he was never part of the Bomber Mafia. Years later, a historian at the U.S. Air Force Academy asked him about his experiences in Alabama.
You get the idea that the Air Corps Tactical School was kind of a think tank, and it was tossing out ideas to the combat units, and they were trying out these ideas. Would you care to comment on that?
Well, I don't know. I can't answer that question.
Did he get swept up in any of the intellectual fervor of the Bomber Mafia? At the moment, they were revolutionizing our understanding of how war ought to be waged. Did he engage in any of those famous midnight debates? Clearly not. There was something in LeMay's makeup, in his obsession with the how and the what, that resisted any intellectual enthusiasms. He could make sure the pilots flew long and straight towards the target. He could instill in them the discipline not to bail out and panic along the way. He could train them to take off in fog. He was drawn to practical challenges. Doctrine left him cold. Later in the interview, LeMay was even more blunt. He said he'd never been convinced by the elaborate logic behind the Schweinfurt raids.
But the idea was they found the ball bearing plants over there, some of these swivel chair target analysts back in the Pentagon. And the idea was if we knock out that plant, which supposedly had the bulk of the ball bearing production in the country, then a war would grind to a halt because there were no bearings.
Some swivel chair target analyst back in the Pentagon? You know who he's talking about, don't you? Haywood Hansell and the Bomber Mafia, with their fanciful conjecture about how to disable the enemy.
The plan was okay. Well, basically okay. But here we are trying to find something to win the war in an easy way. And they ain't no such animal.
All that mattered to Curtis LeMay was the final outcome. He lost 24 planes on the decoy mission to hit Regensburg. Each of those bombers had a crew of 10, which meant 240 men did not return to base. That's 240 letters that had to be written the next day by LeMay and his squadron leaders. Dear Mr. and Mrs. Smith, your son. Dear Mr. and Mrs. Jones, your son. 240 times. And for what? Recently, I talked with an Air Force officer named Ken Israel, who knew LeMay in the general's final years. They used to hunt together. And once, Israel went to LeMay's house in Southern California to deliver some pheasants they had shot at Beale Air Force Base, just north of Sacramento.
I walked into his house respectfully. I rang the doorbell, and he answered it, and he invited me to come in. And I said, sir, I have your pheasants here. And you walk into his foyer, and it was all marble. And there on the wall to the left was a huge mural of Schweinfurt. And so I said, sir, is that Regensburg and Schweinfurt? He said, yes, sonny. We lost a lot of good men.
Curtis LeMay would have one of the most storied careers any Air Force officer would ever have. He planned or commanded countless missions more consequential than the Regensburg-Schweinfurt raid. He would run the Berlin airlift in 1948 and 1949, one of the pivotal events at the start of the Cold War. He would eventually control America's nuclear arsenal as head of the Strategic Air Command. During his time in the service, he met every world leader imaginable, posed for pictures with the kinds of people who the rest of us only read about in history books. He could have hung mementos from any of those things in his foyer, but he didn't. In the entryway to his house, he hung a reminder from his first real encounter with the orthodoxy of the bomber mafia. A reminder of failure and loss. Part 2, The Temptation. Part 2 of The Bomber Mafia takes place in Guam and Japan and all points east. But before we get to that, I want to tell a story from closer to the present. I traveled to Tokyo when I was researching this book, along with my producer, Jacob Smith. And right after we landed, Jacob and I got into a cab and went to visit a museum called the Center of the Tokyo Raids and War Damage. It's a memorial to the events that I'm going to describe in the next few chapters, the outcome of the struggle between the bomber mafia and Curtis LeMay. I go to war museums all the time, like the Imperial War Museums in London, big, grand building with four other branches around the country. You can spend a few weeks going through them. Or memorials. I've been to those too. The Vietnam Veterans Memorial on the Mall in Washington, D.C., Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. Each powerful, moving, designed by world-famous architects, with a presence. So Jacob and I get in our taxi in Tokyo, and I assume that we would be going towards the area where all the museums are, the center of town, near the Imperial Palace. But we don't. We go in the opposite direction, away from the business district and tourists, east, down a very plain commercial street, over a big bridge, further and further, then a left-hand turn down a side street, and the driver stops. And I wonder, was there some misunderstanding? I'd written down the address on a piece of paper. Did I write it down wrong? I show the address to the driver. He nods, points, and sure enough, I squint and I can see the sign for the museum. We're in front of what looks like a medical office building. Three stories, brick. We walk in, and there's a little gift shop to the side. Actually, just a couple of bookshelves. Next to that is what looks like a classroom, with a bunch of folding chairs where an introductory video is playing. Then, through a tiny courtyard, up the stairs to the main exhibit. Linoleum floors, lots of black and white photos on the wall, a scale model of a B-29 hanging from the ceiling, the kind you'd buy in a toy store. Jacob took a picture of me in front of the museum after we were finished. I have it on my phone. It looks like I'm coming from a dentist's appointment. We're all familiar with the two atomic bombs detonated over Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August of 1945. Little Boy and Fat Man, dropped by the Enola Gay. There are grand monuments and memorials to that event, rows upon rows of history books, debates that continue to this day. I was in the midst of finishing this book when the 75th anniversary of those attacks happened. On that day, you had 100 chances to relive the memory. But the center of the Tokyo raids and war damage is not about what happened after the nuclear attacks on Japan. It's about what happened before. From Haywood Hansel to Curtis LeMay, a little bit of history that has been relegated to a side street. Now, why is it on a side street? In some sense, that's the subtext of the second half of this book. Something happened when the Bomber Mafia and Curtis LeMay moved their focus to the other side of the world, from England and Europe to the Mariana Islands in the middle of the Pacific. Something happened that everyone involved found inconvenient, or unbearable, or unspeakable, or maybe all three.
残っているのはレンガのみである。悲惨極まりない。生存者は虚脱状態。
I remember a giant scroll hanging on the wall, one of the rooms upstairs. It was written in beautiful Japanese calligraphy. There was no translation.
倉庫内にて聞きし、親子断末魔の声。修正はするなし。
Sometimes our normal mechanisms of commemoration fail us. And what comes next is an attempt to figure out why. Chapter 6. It would be suicide, boys. Suicide. All war is absurd. For thousands of years, human beings have chosen to settle their differences by obliterating each other. And when we are not obliterating each other, we spend an enormous amount of time and attention coming up with better ways to obliterate each other the next time around. It's all a little strange, if you think about it. Nonetheless, even within that general category of absurd, there is a continuum. The war that was fought in Europe at least resembled previous wars. It was absurd in a familiar way, neighbor against neighbor. The D-Day landing required a short trip across the English Channel. People can swim the English Channel. On the ground, troops marched, held rifles, fired big pieces of artillery. If you gave Napoleon a one-week refresher, he probably could have managed the Allied push across Europe as well as any general from the 20th century.
Hello, NBC. Hello, NBC. This is KGU in Honolulu, Hawaii.
But the Pacific Theater? It was on the other end of the war absurd continuum.
Honolulu has also been attacked and considerable damage done. It is no joke. It is the real war.
The United States and Japan probably had less contact with each other and knew less about each other than any two wartime combatants in history. More importantly, they were as far apart geographically as any two combatants in history. The Pacific War was, by definition, a sea war, and, as the conflict grew more intense, an air war. But the sheer scale of the Pacific battleground made it the kind of air war that no one had ever fought before. For example, at the time of the attack on Pearl Harbor, the workhorse of the U.S. Army Air Forces was the B-17 bomber, also known as the Flying Fortress. That's what LeMay and Ira Aker and Hansel were using in Europe. The Flying Fortress had a range of roughly 2,000 miles, 1,000 miles out and 1,000 miles back. In January of 1944, you couldn't find an airbase controlled by the Allies within 1,000 miles of Tokyo. Australia is more than 4,000 miles from Japan, out of the question for a B-17. Hawaii's just as far. The Philippines made the most sense on paper, but the Philippines had been captured by the Japanese and weren't fully recaptured until late in 1945. In any case, Manila was still 1,800 miles from Tokyo. If you were the United States and you wanted to drop bombs on Japan, how would you do that? Solving that problem took the better part of the war. First step was building the superfortress, the greatest bomber of its day, with an effective range of over 3,000 miles.
They were building the mightiest aircraft in history. They were building a plane for the Army Air Forces that would reduce the huge fortresses and liberators to medium bombers. They were building the Boeing-designed B-29 Super Fortress. And the assembled airmen will listen to words that a few years ago would have been fantastic, but today roll casually off a briefing officer's lips. The target, gentlemen, is Japan.
This mission of reaching Japan required that the U.S. capture the string of three tiny islands in the middle of the Western Pacific: Saipan, Tinian, and Guam. The Mariana Islands, controlled by the Japanese. The Marianas were 1,500 miles across the water from Tokyo, the closest possible spot where you could build a runway. Put a fleet of B-29s on the Marianas, and you could bomb Japan. The Japanese knew that too. Which led to another absurd moment. Some of the ugliest fighting in the entire war was over three tiny clumps of volcanic rock that no one outside the Western Pacific, no one, had even so much as heard of before the war started.
Well, then one morning there's a little island sticking up out, and they tell you that's it. And what our main job was, well, we were supposed to soften them up so the troops in the landing barges could get on the beach.
This is a veteran, Corporal Melvin Dalton, recalling the fight.
The next morning, why, at the crack of dawn, the ocean's just full of ships and barges headed for the beach, and they're just gunfire you can't believe. The dead bodies everywhere, just floating. Nobody had time to pick them up. When those Marines hit those beachheads, it's terrible sometimes.
One by one, over the summer of 1944, the islands fell to the Marines. Whereupon, Heywood Hansel was dispatched from Washington to head up the newly formed 21st Bomber Command, an elite force composed entirely of the newest and most lethal weapon in the Air Force's lineup, the B-29 Superfortress. Their task was to cripple the Japanese war machine from the air, to pave the way for what everyone considered inevitable, a land invasion of Japan. Leading the air attack on Japan was the most important job of Hansel's career. At that point, it was probably the most important job in the entire Army Air Forces. But the air attack plan was, in every sense of the word, absurd. First, consider the B-29. In 1944, it is a brand new airplane, rushed into service. It breaks down. Engines catch on fire. No one's been properly trained to fly it. It has all kinds of idiosyncrasies. And this new weapon is to be launched from just about the least hospitable place imaginable for an Air Force base. The Marianas are hot and humid, blanketed with mosquitoes, torrential rains, no proper buildings or hangars or maintenance facilities or roads, just Quonset huts and tents. Haywood Hansel, a decorated general, the man who wrote the air war plan used against Hitler in Europe, was camping out like a Boy Scout.
Were there a lot of trees, and or was it all sand?
No, it was a lot of rocks. Mm-hmm.
This is Vivian Slewinski, a second lieutenant in the Army Nurse Corps, talking about what it was like on the island of Tinian in those early months after the U.S. took over.
There were rats in the place. They were up in the rafters.
Oh.
And they'd come down and nibble. They nibbled at some of the people's hair.
Oh,
and
no.
A couple of times they came up close to my hands and I just...
Oh. And did they get into the hospital too?
We didn't have a hospital yet.
Oh, okay.
No? Mm-hmm. No. All we had were these Quonset huts.
Mm-hmm.
The sole thing the Marianas had going was that they were within range of Japan. But even that was an exaggeration. The truth is that they were within range only under perfect circumstances. To reach Japan, a B-29 first needed to be loaded up with 20,000 pounds of extra fuel. And because that made the plane dangerously overweight, each B-29 also needed a ferocious tailwind to lift it off the runway. This was as crazy a situation as anyone faced through the entire war. It gets worse. Just listen to Hansel describe his first major attack on Tokyo in the fall of 1944. He's speaking after the war to a class at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs.
Well, the first operation against Japan was called San Antonio 1. It was coordinated with the Joint Chiefs of Staff strategy